Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
We're going to have a very important conversation. Professor Annie Curtis, good morning.
Morning, Brendan.
So Annie, people know you as a Professor of Biology at the Royal College of Surgeons. And people know you from this show and others for talking about body clocks and all kinds of science matters. So today is different. So we're going to talk about how you became very unwell in the last few years and you ended up hospitalised with mental illness. So look, this was your first experience, I know, with full-blown depression. There was a sense, was there, that you always felt it was there waiting for you in a way?
Well, I suppose, Brendan, I would say, first of all, you know, mental illness, like with many families, it's in their family. So for us, we had mental illness on both sides of the family, actually. And because I studied genetics in Trinity College, I had kind of a good understanding of inheritance and all of that. So really, when I was growing up, I was very aware of mental illness and even, you know, mental health hospitals and all of that. And I suppose I was always waiting for the other shoe to drop with me, with my own mental health. And when I, you know, got into my late teens, I was aware that that's where the an initial peak of mental illness can occur. Got through that, no issues whatsoever. And then, of course, we were about to start a family and I was thinking about postnatal depression and I thought, it's going to get me then. And we had two beautiful girls. And it didn't affect me. So by the time I got to 40, I kind of thought, you know, we're done, yeah. Right? So I didn't really think about it then, you know, as I went into my 40s. But then things really started to go south when I actually turned 45. So what happened was, it was, you know, this was 2022, I'm 47 now. And if you remember, the world was beginning to open up after COVID. And it was March and I was going to a conference in 22 and I just felt uneasy. There was just something, you know, I just didn't feel myself. And I would actually call myself sort of an extrovert in denial. So I am a true extrovert, but I actually would like to be an introvert. I have this idea that there I am in the corner reading books and, you know, because I'm an academic, but I actually nearly have to hang off people to get energy. So this was a real difference in kind of my personality.
Okay, so you were anxious about meeting people.
I was really anxious about meeting people. And I had a real sense of no one cares what I say. Like I had a lot of self-doubt. Now, self-doubt would be something that, you know, wasn't strange to me. But this was like self-doubt on steroids. Like this was like self-doubt and just a feeling of being awkward. And, you know, not being worthy, that I just never had before. Really lost my confidence. So my confidence was completely shot. And for that whole year of 22, I cancelled things. I wasn't able to go to conferences. I wasn't able to give talks. I probably cancelled things in here as well. I just wasn't able to do anything.
Like, you couldn't face the world.
I just couldn't face the world. And I became very small. Let's just say it that way. You know, I just did the minimum. But I thought, look, it's post-COVID. It must be that everyone had, you know, mental health issues during COVID. It's probably because of that. And then, ironically, the sleep went. And it's ironic because I talk a lot about sleep because I'm a body clock researcher. And once the sleep went, I thought, oh, hold on a second here. This is a little bit different. And I was worrying about everything, worrying about my job. I would call it now debilitating anxiety at this point, coming to the end of 22, beginning of 23, really feelings of just worthlessness, hopelessness. And I was scared. Like, I was really scared. And I don't mean to be flippant about this, Brendan, but I would have taken anything other than mental illness. Like, I wanted it to be anything other than mental illness.
Yeah.
So I was looking, because of the shame, I think, that's associated with mental illness, the shame that I felt about it. I would have taken anything else. You know, I was looking for everything else but mental illness. So the anxiety probably then morphed into depression in 23.
Okay. And what was the difference? What did depression feel like or look like for you? Because I think people people have this idea that they think they know what depression is, but I think most people don't know what depression is.
And I certainly didn't know. And okay. I think, you know, and I think we'll talk about this. I think language is so important when we talk about mental illness and how we describe things. Like I read somewhere comparing sadness to depression is like comparing a firecracker to an atomic bomb. Like they are just completely different things. Depression isn't an emotion. Sadness is an emotion. Depression isn't. Depression okay. is a clinical disease.
And what does a full-blown depression look like? What did it look like for you?
Well, the way I would describe it is nearly to compare to anxiety. So for me, like anxiety felt like I was coming out of my skin. You know, it was just this feeling that everything was triggering me. I was like a wire without insulation in a wire, in an electric field. That's okay. what anxiety felt like yeah. for me. Just, you know, I could nearly feel it. And when I'd be anxious, I'd have to almost stretch. You know, I'd be doing this with my hands and just to almost get that feeling of I'm about to come out of my skin.
Weirdly, there's an energy so in anxiety.
Anxiety, you are heightened to everything. Like anxiety, you are a wire without insulation.
Okay.
Depression for me felt like I was paralyzed in my skin. So depression feels like you are just in quicksand, that you can think to a certain degree, but you can't execute those things. So I'll give you an example. When I was severely depressed before I went into hospital, I couldn't make the dinner. I couldn't figure out that you had to put the potatoes on 30 minutes ahead of the meat. I couldn't do that. Okay. And I think that really shows yeah. where your cognitive function has really declined in this illness. With depression, and it's an awful condition because your brain is lying to you. And I'll refer a little bit to some of the ways that PJ Gallagher explains it, because I think, you know, he was the one when he said some of the things, I was like, I've never heard it explained like this. Like he would say that depression is your most articulate liar. Like depression knows your shame triggers. It knows the things that are going to get you and it will start talking to you about them. So for me, depression was, there was a lot of self-doubt. There was a lot of, I can't do my job. You know, I just can't do it. I don't know why I focused on my job, but I did. It was because that's obviously something that I would have a bit of self-doubt about. How did I become a professor? You know, I shouldn't be here. I only got this through luck, through, you know, X, Y and Z. So for me, I was very much focused on, I just can't do this job. But even the mundane things like making the dinner, I couldn't go outside the house. I couldn't brush my teeth. You know, you the self-care aspect completely goes as well with depression. You just don't, it's so hard to explain it. It is like being in quicksand. But
so you could you function at all?
Very, like, you could barely get up in the morning. Oh, and that was the other thing. So with anxiety, I couldn't sleep. Depression, I couldn't get out of the bed.
Okay.
And, you know, people will say, you know, remember years ago you'd say, she's taken to the bed, right? So I had taken to the bed for a period of time as well. And I think as well, Brendan, I think it's worth the mention of how difficult I think this illness is for carers, for their loved ones, because you have an illness that is lying to you, right? But you are lying to them. Like you are covering up how sick you are. So I think it's like catching dust for carers in this situation. And I would say that because I know some people, their loved ones did not get through this. You know what I mean? They did not come out the other side. And what I would say to the carers is that was not your fault. That was the disease's fault. It's so difficult, I think, to care for somebody.
So were you unreachable to your loved ones?
So I probably wasn't as unreachable as I think other people may become, because I think I got the help in time. I think that's a critical piece, and I got the help that I needed in time as well. But I would have impression managed with my family. Yes, you know, because it's so shameful, right? So, and this disease wants you to become invisible. You know, it wants to take you out. But you're not going to say that to your family and friends, because in some way, that's what you think should happen as well. Do you see?
Yeah.
So I think it's so difficult. PJ Gallagher said as well, it was like every cell in his body was trying to kill him. And that is depression. Absolutely. And you feel you are unworthy, and you feel that the solution is to potentially go down to those very dark places. And that's why I think for carers, I don't think there's enough spoken about carers in this situation,
because they are
absolutely part of the solution. But at the same time, it's like crazy making for them because it's so difficult for them. Like, for example, somebody said to me, one of their loved ones is really sick at the moment, but he's driving up and down, right? He's driving out of the hospital on a Saturday and he's going home and he's coming back. And they can't understand how he can drive but be so sick. And I was like, they're just different parts of the brain. It's different parts of the brain that are affected between depression and driving.
So were you getting treatment? Was it working?
So I was, I went to my GP, and I think we might talk about the difference, I think, you know, why hospital is so needed for some people when they get so ill. I would have gone to my GP. My GP was fantastic. But I needed 24-hour care. That was what I needed. And, you know, when I...
What point did you accept that?
I probably had been really sick with depression for about 2 months.
Not leaving the house and not really functioning where you
not really functioning.
Okay.
You know, not
yeah.
not you know, okay. if you would have seen me, I think somebody might say she's kind of a shadow of her former self.
Okay.
You know, people who did see me thought, and my family was aware of this as well, but your family don't know what's going on in your head, and that's what really makes depression difficult. You know, they're not inside your head. They don't really know how sick you are.
And you can't explain it or won't explain
it. Or you don't want
it.
To or yeah. you think. Or there's always this like, I'll be better next week. This will work for me. That will work for me. And I think we should probably maybe say as well, I do think the messages around mental health and mental illness are confusing. I think they should be
okay.
in two different buckets.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I think for somebody who is mentally ill, I think the messages around mental health can be very alienating. Because you think, oh, if I could only go out and go for that walk, I would feel better.
Yeah.
If I could only do that yoga class, let's say, I'm just giving examples.
Yeah.
All of these things that are mental health messages, which are really important, but I actually think it should be called something different. I think it should
yeah.
be called lifestyle health, not mental health. I think we should keep the mental health for the mental illness part, because mental illness is not the same as mental health. It is a disease. You know, it's like
okay.
saying somebody who's a bit out of breath has the same condition as somebody with asthma. Like,
so
they are very different.
This is not the same continuum. Like, the things that a lot of people do to keep their mood up and to keep from having a flat day or whatever, that's a different thing entirely.
So I think they're kind of on the same spectrum.
Yeah.
And that's where do you draw that line? Like,
yeah.
they have to be on the same spectrum, because you feel sad. Okay, so you feel sad. Okay, there's parts of that morph into maybe, you know, when you're depressed, you feel sad as well. And I don't know how best to explain it, but all I know is sometimes you need 24-hour care.
Yeah.
That is what you need. And
was it hard for you to accept that? Because I'd say, I'll admit, like a lot of people, one of my biggest fears would be going into a psychiatric institution.
Yeah, yeah. And even I think the word, I'd like to rename lots of things.
Yeah,
as
yeah,
hear,
yeah.
I think the word psychiatric hospital and institution, we should really stop saying those things.
Okay.
I think we should be calling them like mental illness hospitals.
Sanctuaries.
I wouldn't even say sanctuary.
No,
I don't know.
No.
I suppose I have a thing against institution. And it's
yeah,
funny,
okay.
like I grew up in New Ross and... in Enniscorthy, there was the red brick building that was a mental health hospital.
Yeah, there was a red brick in Cork up.
Oh,
the
was
hill
there
as
a
well,
red brick?
Literally called the red brick.
Yes, yeah,
yeah.
And my husband's from Cork, so I remember him even showing that to me.
Yeah.
And like we would call that the lunatic asylum.
Yeah.
So that's
and
not
worse.
That long.
Yeah.
That's not that long ago. And I think even when you think about, you know, psychiatric hospitals, I think movies come into play. You think of the movie Girl Interrupted. You think of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And even to this day, I hear stuff that I think that's not helpful.
So more shame.
More shame. Absolutely. And more of like, you shouldn't like, you don't belong there. Like, you know, you should be here, not over there.
Yeah.
Because they're the people who are X, Y, and Z, and you're here doing ABC. It makes this division. And, you know...
So how was it?
Well, I would have to say it was scary for me to do it. And it's funny, I felt that if I took this step, it would harm my reputation, but in reality, it saved my life. And I couldn't have been more wrong about the place. Now, I was very privileged, and we might talk about privilege and mental illness as well. I was very privileged to be able to go to St. Patrick's University Hospital, which is a private hospital. And for me, I couldn't be more wrong about the place. And I suppose there's four key things I'd like to talk about hospital that maybe people wouldn't realise, because I certainly didn't before I went in. When you go into a hospital like St. Patrick's, you have a multidisciplinary team just completely wrapped around you. You know, that is a psychiatrist, a psychologist, psychiatric nurses, pharmacists, family therapists. You know, you have the whole kit and caboodle, okay? And they are all like teamed up. So it's the same with cancer. Cancer, you'll have a multidisciplinary team. That's the way healthcare is now.
Okay.
I didn't realise that for mental illness, it was the same, okay? And that's really important because you've all these disciplines feeding in to you, right? And the care is completely connected. Everyone's connected to each other. They're all sitting in the same room discussing your case each week. Psychiatrists have a much larger array of medicines than GPs have because they're psychiatrists. You know, that's their specialties, like oncologists. And I didn't get that, right? I didn't understand that that was the case. And as well as that, they can say, like, there might be a drug for psychosis, which they'll use for schizophrenia, but at a lower dose, it'll be very helpful for maybe depression. And they can do all of that. And as well as that, in a hospital, they can change the medications really quickly, you know, because they're looking at you every day. So they'll see she's improving, she's not. We need to increase the dose, we need to decrease the dose. That cannot happen in the community.
Okay.
It just cannot. And then the last thing I will say is, and I certainly didn't understand this, is that some of the recovery is because you're in a hospital with other people who've gone through the same thing.
Really?
Yeah. Like the recovery, sorry, and I might get upset.
You're not ashamed.
There is no shame. There is no shame. And... what I would say, and I even at the time I was kind of recording voice recordings of myself. Like, Brenda, I probably should have been a journalist, to be honest with you, more than a scientist.
You documented this very well. You were telling this story very well, yeah.
So, there's no ego. There's no ego because the gig is up. If you're in there...
The gig is up, yeah.
Yeah, if you're in there, you are mentally ill.
And not having to pretend anymore a huge relief, is that adding to the whole problem?
It was, you know, once I started to get well, just the recovery and the treatment I got from the other patients was just incredible. Hearing their story, hearing some of them, look, some of them were back in, you know what I mean? Just understanding the fragility of life, just seeing people at their most vulnerable. And I would actually say, you know, when people are at their most vulnerable, it's when they're shining their brightest light because everything else is stripped away. The pretense, the armour, the whatever, you know. And I certainly wouldn't have realised that the recovery was as much down to the patients, other patients who I met. Amazing people. And from, Brendan, from all walks of life. Lawyers, doctors, teachers, milkmen, bin men. It was everyone, you know. And like St. Pat's has maybe a bed capacity of 250, I'd say about, right? It's always about 90% full. Normal stay of recovery or stay in hospital is about 6 to 8 weeks. So there's a lot of people going in there, you know. And once I opened up to people, you know, people would say, oh yeah, sure. My friend was in there. Sure, but so many people will not talk about it. And because people don't talk about it, when somebody else gets into this situation, they feel so alone.
Yeah.
Because they've no one else to kind of go, such and such, you know, or maybe I can even talk to such and such.
So did you spend 6 to 8 weeks in there? And then when you come out, how far along in recovery are you, or how does that all work?
So I was a bit longer, right, in total. I was probably about 5 months and started to come out for about the 6 months. And with regards to recovery, like, I would say we talk about the road to recovery. I kind of call it the road of recovery.
Okay.
Because there's no destination. Like, we're all changing. You know, I used to kind of think when I was sick, oh, I want to be the same as I was back in 2020.
Yeah.
But no one's the same. You know what I mean? Yeah. Whether you're sick or not, you've changed. And for me, the road of recovery is you get on that road and sometimes you're going forward and sometimes you're pausing and sometimes you're going back. And sometimes you're going back because you have to go back to go forward. You know, it's and it takes a long time. Like, certainly for me, I think there's kind of three things. There was probably clinical recovery, social recovery and personal recovery.
Yeah.
The clinical recovery came first. You know, I was better. I could function. The social recovery came next. And for me, probably the personal recovery, I'm probably still trying to deal with that. Like, trying to kind of...
What does that mean?
I mean, I suppose I've accepted that I got mentally ill, but I still have a hard time. You know, it was so hard for my family, you know, so I still have a hard time with that. And accepting that and forgiving myself for that.
You feel guilty?
I think anyone who's gone through this journey will go, why didn't I go into hospital sooner? Why didn't I do this? Why didn't I do that? You know, you have so many ifs and buts. And like psychiatry, I think psychiatrists are amazing because unlike other professions in the medical community, there is no scan. You know, there is no blood test. It is what the patient says to you. And you have a condition where you are probably trying to cover up a lot of the stuff.
Mm.
So I think it's an amazing profession. But at the same time, yeah, it's just a tough illness. It really
yeah.
is.
And it's tough too, because you say about the guilt and the beating yourself up about should I have gone in earlier and everything. And then you kind of go, well, that's it as well. Like, where do I end and the depression begins? You know what I mean? Is that more of the lies? Like,
yes, yeah. And certainly I've gotten a lot of help since I've been out of hospital. You know, I'm with a fantastic community mental health team. Fantastic, absolutely
yeah.
fantastic. Couldn't ask for better. And you know what they will say to me is, you can't think like that because you were sick at that time. You were not thinking straight.
Right.
You know, it's easy to kind of say, oh, I should have done this when I'm in the hole of my brain health. It's very, very hard when I had basically brain failure. And that's what I would call depression, is brain failure. It's no different to heart failure. It
yeah.
is the brain has failed.
So go on, give me your view as a biologist on the science of it, because I think a lot of people can have a different model of what depression is based on where they're kind of coming from, you know, and people talk about a sickness of the soul and all that kind of thing. What's the biological understanding
yeah.
that you have now of it?
Yeah, and I didn't have this at the start of my journey.
Okay.
I only found
you
this out.
It was you, like,
yeah. my bad soul,
yeah.
you know?
yeah, exactly.
So what I found out afterwards is that there's actually structural changes that are happening in the main cell in the brain. So the brain is a funny organ, right? It's made up of these cells called neurons, which people will probably have heard of, or neuronal. You know, people might hear of neuronal growth or stuff like that, or maybe not. I have to say, it's funny. My mom read the article that I wrote in the Independent, which I thought was like really easy to understand. And she was like, I had a hard time when you went on to the science. So I need to try to be a bit better in how
okay.
I explain the science. But there are these cells that literally, like, they almost go hand in hand with their neighbour, right? So, like, they, you know, like fingers interlinking. That's what these cells do,
yeah.
right? And in order for these cells to be really connected, there's like little, if you think about maybe branches, right? So branches from one tree, branches from another tree, and then there's twigs. And the twigs are kind of what keep the branches together, aren't they? You know
yeah,
what I mean? Like
yeah.
they'll hold them together if you think of like two big trees together. And in depression, those twigs are gone. Right. So the connections between the neurons are not as stable. Right. So that and with very more kind of high tech brain scanning, we can actually see that now. It's like part of the brain just shuts down. Right. Because those neurons are not connected. So there are structural changes in the brain that cause depression. Now, when I read that, Brendan, it was like, ah, it was just like, I, you know, I couldn't have walked or yogaed or meditated myself out of this.
Yes.
Do you know what
I mean?
And I think the job of medication is to just bring you out of the hole. You know, it's not it's not everything. It's absolutely not. And those mental health things, then they kick in.
Okay.
But sometimes with depression, you are in a hole and you cannot get out of that unless potentially you take medication. Medication can get you out of the hole.
And back to a point where you can learn to live again.
And back to the point where you can leave the house. You know, or you can brush your teeth, or you can go for the walk. Like the way I think about it, the analogy I use is if you think about your brain like a bike, okay, mental health is the bike just needs the tires to be pumped up a little bit, right? The oil, the chain to be oiled. Mental illness is you're on the bike, the wheel's falling off, so is the handlebars. Do you know what I mean? And the whole thing is like broken in two. In order to get yourself back on that bike, medication can help, you know, can help put those things back together that you just can't do yourself. And it's not just medication, it's medication, it's therapy, it's exercise, it's love, it's connection, it's all those things.
Yeah. Just to say to you, we're getting so many messages from people who are going through what you are describing, who have been through it or who are caring for someone in their life who's going through it. I'll read some of them in a while. So, why do you think it happened to you when it did then? Because people do kind of often think there's a reason for these things, or can be life events or something can send someone down the road.
And that can be true. You know, stressors can definitely tip you over. And it all, you know, depends on your genetics as well. You can have a genetic susceptibility, which I do, because it's in my family. But I only realised this summer that it wasn't a coincidence that I got so ill at the age of 45. And I was reading a study where I nearly fell off the chair. Okay, like I read it. Which basically showed that there was a twofold increase in major depressive disorder and bipolar disorder with women during their perimenopausal period. Right? This is like first onset symptoms. It's exactly what happened to me.
Okay.
And because I had spent a lot of time thinking, Had I had this when I was in my 20s and 30s? And I was nearly driving myself mad. Yeah. I was nearly trying to fit the round, whatever, you know, square peg, round hole, all of that. I was nearly trying to do that, you know, with my life, with my narrative of before now. Yeah. And I couldn't.
Wasn't out of character, that you had been building to this area.
There might have been episodes, you know, that maybe not as severe as this, but this was something that had happened in my 20s, because that's when the first peak of mental major depressive disorder, bipolar happens, right, is in your 20s. But now we know there's this second peak. There's a second peak in perimenopausal.
Okay, and not the menopause.
Not the perimenopause.
When people think they're just kind of dipping in the shallows of things.
Yeah, yeah. And as I said to you before, Brendan, I think the wording should be changed as well. Like menopause kind of sounds like that. That's the fine, you know, that's the big act, right? And perimenopause is the warm-up act coming in before it. But really, the symptoms of menopause in general are worse in the perimenopausal period. So, you know, when I started feeling anxious, I thought it was perimenopause. And I went to the GP and I went on HRT. And, you know, it helped a little bit, but it didn't help a lot. And I suppose the message I'd love to get across is it doesn't have to be one or the other. Like, it doesn't have to be perimenopause, you can be treated with HRT, or you've, like, mental illness.
Okay.
It can be that perimenopause is the period when you become susceptible for the first time to a mental illness. And you may need to take things for perimenopause, but you also might need to do stuff for mental illness as well. Because I feel there's a number of women who are shamed that they are feeling like this in the perimenopausal period, or are trying all the perimenopausal stuff and it's not working for them, and they're thinking, which was me, and they're thinking, oh, there's really something wrong with me now. You know, this is absolutely serious. When I just love for people to know that there is the susceptibility during the perimenopausal period, not for mental health issues, for mental illness. So for bipolar and for major depressive disorder.
Okay, so we should be talking about this.
I think
we do talk more a lot about the menopause now.
We do, and it's fantastic. But I think we talk about the mental health issues of menopause and perimenopause, like the anxiety and the brain fog. I don't think we're talking enough about mental illness. Like, I'd love to start a national conversation talking about mental illness and the perimenopausal period, because okay. I think it's really important.
Do you know what? I think you just did. So there you go. Listen, for someone listening who has a friend or a loved one going through depression, and as we were saying, it can be very, very hard for them, and the person possibly not communicating what's really going on and maybe unreachable, what can they do for somebody?
I think, first of all, I would say to carers, again, you know, sometimes you don't need to give the solutions. You know, sometimes you just need to say, look, I see you're struggling. I see it. You don't have to say you're not. I can see it. I know you well. I know this is not you. I'm not going to try to give you solutions. I'm just going to be here. I'm just going to be right beside you. And we're going to go through this together. Sometimes that's all you have to say. Because I think sometimes as humans, we love to make sense. You know, we're very logical. Mm. So we love to try to give solutions.
Problem solving.
Problem solving. And sometimes
you're talking about men here mainly.
I am not, Brendan. Yeah. I am absolutely not. Yeah. But okay. I just think sometimes, and I think we as humans can see it in other people, and sometimes we're afraid to say it to somebody. And I would say to people, don't be afraid. If you see somebody is struggling, say it to them. I see it. I see it in your face. Okay. I see it in your voice. I just know you, and I know there is something wrong. You know, will you come for a cup of coffee? Can we talk about this? You know, there's no blame. There's no judgment. I just know you're not yourself.
Okay. And be there.
Yeah.
Annie, I know that probably wasn't the easiest thing you've ever done, but I think a lot of people really appreciate it. That was a very useful conversation. Well done. Professor Annie Curtis, thank you so much.
Thanks, Brendan.